Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo. Serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
It's quite serious. It affects at least 3 million Americans, and 250,000 Canadians right now are living with hepatitis C. And really, it's quite possible the numbers in the U.S. are double that. A newer estimate has come out suggesting that maybe as high as 7 million Americans currently have hepatitis C. So the majority of people with hepatitis C don't even know they have it, and they may have had it for years or decades.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, your host and the voice for patient safety. I'm happy you're taking the time to hang out with me for a while because, as usual, I have lots to tell you. Well, to begin with, you just heard a snippet from today's guest, a gal who had hepatitis C for years and years with little hope of a cure. Recently, she took part in a clinical trial where the medications gave her a complete cure. And she's here today to share her story. For some reason, hepatitis C is on the rise. And in fact, I didn't know this at all. But death certificate data indicates that hepatitis C is the most common infectious cause of death, way beyond and exceeding HIV, hepatitis B, and tuberculosis all combined. Did you know this? Well, I didn't. Well, this means that hepatitis C-related mortality is quite underestimated. And the only way to find out if you have this silent disease is via a blood test. So lots more to know about this, and we'll get to all of that in a short bit. But for now, I have something else to share with you, so let's get to it. Because right now, it's time for the healthcare hazard of the week. Medical malpractice. I haven't talked about medical malpractice and lawsuits in several years because the focus of this program is to avoid any untoward medical encounter by becoming an informed and an empowered consumer, thus avoiding the need to consider suing our doctors. But recently I had the opportunity to read the most current outcomes from the annual Medscape Malpractice Report 2015. Why most doctors get sued. And the findings are quite interesting, and I'd like to share it just a bit with you as a way to help us understand the physician side of malpractice as well as the demographic aspect. Often, when we think of malpractice, we think only of the patient side, and we give little thought to what it must be like to be a physician. Now, in order to win a medical malpractice case against a physician, a patient must prove that the physician owed the patient a duty, that the physician breached that duty, which is called negligence, and that the physician's breach in duty caused the patient to suffer damages. Now, there are many ways to demonstrate what a physician's duties were, and that's considered the standard of care, and whether the physician lived up to those duties. Now, can you imagine if where you worked, you had this kind of scrutiny dangling over every conversation? Every decision, every word? Talk about stressful. Not only are all decisions a matter of life and death, one wrong move and you're looking at a giant legal mess. Oh, no thanks. I'll stick to radio and speaking. Well, the Medscape report says, malpractice suits have produced widespread disillusionment among physicians concerning care of patients, the legal system, and medicine as a profession. 30% of physicians reported that they would treat patients differently because of a lawsuit. One advised cynically, treat all patients as potential cases for lawsuits. Another physician said, we spend an enormous time training staff how to document every event of patient contact. They are trained to think of any way a patient could sue us from the time they walk in the door. It's ridiculous. A few physicians wrote that being sued was the reason they were leaving or thinking of leaving medicine, with 7% of the respondents leaving their practice because of malpractice suits. Over half of the physicians who reported being sued said that they used standard of care and would not have changed a thing. 19% would have used better documentation. Almost a tenth of the respondents believed that they could have communicated more carefully, and 6% would have spent more time with patients or their families. Now, on the flip side, 8% would have tested more aggressively to cover themselves, and 12% would not have taken on such patients. Many physicians also said they would be more aggressive in caring for their patients themselves and not rely on other staff or colleagues. A number of respondents emphasized the importance of telling the truth. One doctor wrote, "It is a very bizarre situation. Each word that you say has to be measured and thought about, and it is a very strange way to have a conversation with someone." Which brings me back to something I mentioned last week when talking about treating patients as a patient or as a part of a population. And I mentioned the initiative called Choosing Wisely, which was implemented in theory to reduce the amount of unnecessary testing by providing a list of do's and don'ts for physicians and as a way to spark conversations with the patient. And while some of the guidelines are appropriate for physicians to always follow, other Choosing Wisely guidelines subject practitioners to a low but significant risk of missing serious diseases if these guidelines are actually followed. And my instinct in questioning this Choosing Wisely edict last week is confirmed and shows I am not alone when over a third of the respondents to the Medscape survey believe that the Choosing Wisely initiative will lead to more lawsuits. Among the verbal responses to this survey when talking about avoiding future lawsuits or long-term effects, no respondents who had been sued said that they would test less, and many now test more. In a Medscape article, Dr. Mark Siegel said, "It isn't just fear of lawsuits that drive testing." He added, "There's a philosophy of practice that encourages defensive medicine. It's part of the culture of not wanting to miss anything and not being criticized for not covering all the bases." So what does a doctor who is likely to get sued look like from a demographic perspective? According to recent studies among all physicians, obstetricians, gynecologists, OBGYNs, and surgeons are most likely to be sued. Psychiatrists and pediatricians are the least likely to be sued, and primary care physicians fall somewhere in between. 85% of the OBGYNs, 83% of general surgeons, and 79% of orthopedists reported having been sued, and male doctors were nearly 2.5 times more likely to have legal claims made against them than women doctors. And this is interesting. The risk of recurrence increased with the numbers of previous paid claims. For example, as compared with physicians who only had one previous paid claim, physicians who had 3 paid claims had 3 times the risk of incurring another. Over a recent 10-year period, a small number of physicians with distinctive characteristics accounted for a disproportionately large number of paid malpractice claims. So more seems to imply more. The study also shows that by age 54, 64% of the physicians who responded had experienced at least one malpractice suit over the course of their careers. After age 60, the percentage rose to about 80%. As one respondent wrote, "The older you get, the more you have to lose." In this year's survey, the largest percentage of those who faced lawsuits were in-office-based solo practices, 70%, or single specialty groups, 64%. And the second lowest percentage, which was 53%, reported was from physicians in office-based multi-specialty groups. So ownership may play a role in the higher risk in solo practices and single specialty groups. When asked about the nature of their lawsuits, respondents could check as many options as were relevant. Tied in first place at 31% were lawsuits related to a failure to diagnose and patients suffering abnormal injuries. In a 2011 JAMA study, lawsuits in the outpatient settings were more likely to be due to diagnostic issues and in the inpatient setting from surgical errors. Failure to treat at 12% was in third place and far behind the first two. So what about doctors suing other doctors? 3/4 or more of physicians who answered this survey would not sue another doctor, even if the damages were caused by physician error. So how can this dysfunctional system be fixed? Respondents were able to choose multiple options for the best way to discourage lawsuits. The great majority, 81%, believed that malpractice cases should be screened for merit by a medical panel before they can proceed. About half thought that one approach would be to try the case before a health court. Nearly two-thirds believed in caps on non-economic damages, and 37% wanted to ban lawyers from taking cases on contingency. Among verbal suggestions, unsurprisingly, many urged tort reform by putting a cap or ceiling on award amounts, but by far the most popular suggestion, particularly among male respondents, was to make the losing side pay. Interesting. If a patient thought they would lose, would they still consider moving forward with a lawsuit? I'm not sure that makes sense. What if they have a case but had a bad attorney? Now, how about saying I'm sorry? Do sorry and apology laws work? Although programs employing apologies are being tested, when asked if saying I'm sorry would have helped, the answer was a resounding no at 81%. Among the verbal comments to this question, most physicians reported that they didn't say they were sorry because it wasn't their fault, that it would have made no difference, or that they were among many others named and hadn't even met the plaintiff. More than a few said that greed was the motivating factor. And those who reported that they had expressed sorrow said that it would not have made a difference. So, to summarize the report, the current system of compensating patients for medical errors is not working and is leading to profound disillusionment among those in the medical profession. The Medscape survey revealed major discouragement with the system and a sense of powerlessness. Now, on the plus side, evidence suggests that there is at least some improvement. Paid claims decreased from 18.6 per thousand physicians in 2002 to 9.9 in 2013. Of these claims, 96.6 were from settlements and only 3.4 from verdicts. Still, there is no evidence that errors have declined, and to date, no clear solutions have emerged that resolve the tension that these errors produce between physicians, patients, and lawyers. When we asked to verbalize their experience, physicians who responded to the Medscape survey typically described feelings of betrayal by patients, humiliation, and disillusionment with the legal system. One physician said, "The evils of human nature on display, greed, dishonesty, corruption, and clever lawyering trumps truth." Well, I'm not sure I believe that, but bottom line, medical malpractice lawsuits are expensive. They're time-consuming and emotionally draining affairs that often turn nasty, both for the patient and the provider. Before you decide to sue your doctor, make sure you are prepared to deal with the aggravation, the exhaustion, and the potential financial ramifications. There clearly is no answer to this situation. Mistakes will happen. People are human. I don't think anyone goes to work with a distinct plan to ruin a patient's life. But clearly, there is work to be done, and it seems that it often has little to do with lack of training or shoddy work or equipment. It seems to come down to the softer side of medicine. So, the best I can offer to both sides is, doctors, slow down. Pay attention. Take the time necessary to understand the symptoms and the diagnosis and the person. Communicate with heart. Offer an environment that encourages safe participation. And patients, you and I are not totally without accountability here. Let's help our doctors do the right thing by being informed healthcare consumers. Be honest, ask questions, challenge decisions, and if you feel too shy or scared, remember, the name of this program is the name of this program for a reason. You have to speak up and stay alive. Speak up and stay alive. Five simple words that address a complex problem, and that is your safety when it comes to every healthcare or hospital encounter, or the safety of your family and friends. These words need to be in your mind and on your lips. And to help with that, I wrote the book Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Hospital Survival Guide, on the recommended reading list of the U.S. Army's Medical Department Office of Quality Management. And it should be on your reading list too. Get a copy for yourself. Give some away as important gifts. Bring the book to the hospital with you. Lay it on the tray table. Now, without saying a word, everyone knows that you are an e-patient, equipped, and eager to get out unharmed. You can purchase online for only $19.95 at the website speakupandstayalive.com or call me and order by phone 440-725-5462. That's speakupandstayalive.com or 440-725-5462. Speak up and stay alive. The book tells you how, and I hope you do.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety. Today we have returning Kim Goldberg. She is an award-winning poet and journalist and the author of 7 books. She holds a degree in biology from the University of Oregon. Now, Kim contracted hepatitis C in the early 1970s, and she was cured in 2015 through a clinical trial of Harvoni and ribavirin. She lives in Nanaimo, British Columbia, where she is an avid bird watcher, hiker, and nature lover. And she is with us today to share her story about conquering hepatitis C, as she tells so beautifully in her newest book, Undetectable. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show, Pat.
Before you share your story, in case some of our listeners need a little mini course, what is hepatitis C?
Well, hepatitis C is a blood-borne virus that primarily damages the liver, although really it is a body-wide illness. But for people who know anything at all about hepatitis C, they tend to think of it as, a liver disease. And although a small percentage of people who contract it do actually clear it spontaneously through their own immune system, maybe 15 to 20% of the people who contract it will be able to get rid of it on their own, all the rest of us go on and end up being stuck with it in a chronic form for years and even decades, well, really our whole lives until now in this age of when the cure is now available. And so what happens is hepatitis C is very slowly and insidiously, but persistently, damaging the liver and making it more and more scarred, millions of tiny little micro scars that, of course, very much limit its ability to push blood through it, which is essential, or, you know, filter all our blood through it. And so we just a whole lot of debilities and disabilities will eventually develop in a person who has chronic hepatitis C. And certainly the virus can absolutely lead to cirrhosis, liver cancer, and death. Now, that doesn't happen in everybody, but that is a potential for everyone with hepatitis C. So it's quite serious. It affects at least 3 million Americans, and 250,000 Canadians right now are living with hepatitis C. And really, it's quite possible the numbers in the U.S. are double that. A newer estimate has come out suggesting that maybe as high as 7 million Americans currently have hepatitis C. So we're talking a very large number of people affected here. In fact, it's estimated that more than half of the people, the majority of people with hepatitis C, don't even know they have it, and they may have had it for years or decades. I had it for probably 25 years before I was diagnosed, and I was just astonished by the diagnosis. I would have never expected. I knew I had some physical problem, and that's why I kept going into the doctor about various things, but I never in a million years would have thought liver. And this is the situation most people find themselves in when they're first diagnosed with hepatitis C. It never occurred to them that it was liver.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kim, how do folks contract hepatitis C?
Well, it does require blood-to-blood contact. And so certainly a common mode of transmission in North America and historically has been injection drug use. And I myself probably almost certainly did contract it that way from injection drug use when I was a teenager in the very early 1970s. But people shouldn't assume from that that if they haven't, that if they have no history with injection drug use and, oh, they're safe, they don't need to get tested. In fact, everybody really needs to get tested, because what we don't think about when we hear, oh, blood-to-blood transmission, which is the mode of transmission, we don't think about the fact that really prior to the early 1990s, even anything like dental visits, hospital visits, even some perhaps doctor office visits, ear piercings, tattooings, none of these things necessarily followed the adequate protocols. There were so many possible ways a person could have come in contact, and still today could come in contact with infected blood. Protocols at hospitals, clinics, and dental offices are, of course, much tighter now, but we're at a point now where everybody does need to get tested, particularly everybody of the baby boom generation born between 1945 and 1965. But it's a simple blood test, and then we'll know, because we're at a point now where we can cure it. So if you've got it, let's find out and get people set up to get cured.
Well, now maybe take us on your journey. So how did you find out, and then how did you get cured?
As I mentioned, I probably contracted it in 1970, 1971, when I was 16, 17 years old. So then I went on, got my degree in biology, began a career as a freelance journalist in Canada at that point, doing a great deal of news reporting. And this went on for years, a couple of decades, and then it just got harder and harder for me to get anything done. I was experiencing tremendous energy loss. I had just nausea constantly and would be dizzy when I stood up. I had fierce itching all over the surface of my skin. I had, even though I was quite young, I had arthritis-type symptoms in my knees. My knees were stiff and painful. My fingers and knuckles on my hands were stiff and painful. And it's like, what? And so I kept going back into the doctor with these seemingly unrelated symptoms. And this is so typical of people who have not yet been diagnosed, who have hepatitis C and have not yet been diagnosed. They have all of these seemingly unrelated symptoms. They make trip after trip to the doctor. They get prescriptions. I avoided the prescriptions, but people will get prescriptions for anything from, anti-nausea medications, antidepressants, anti-arthritis medications, none of which are really necessary, because these are all secondary consequences of hepatitis C, but that's just not known to anyone yet. So finally, by 1995, somebody gave me a hepatitis C test, and boom, that was the answer. That actually was the basis for all of this panoply of other problems, seemingly unrelated problems, and tremendous brain fog as well, I should point out. That was one of the most debilitating things for me. My head was just so clouded so much of the time that it actually got very hard for me to continue with journalism work, because I couldn't count on when my brain would be functioning. And so I was diagnosed in 1995, and not nearly as much was known about hepatitis C then as now, and there wasn't any kind of to me, acceptable treatment, and certainly no guarantee of a cure, and no, absolutely no non-toxic treatment. So I didn't do any medical intervention at that time. There was nothing that was acceptable to me. But I did do as much online research as I could, and you wouldn't believe the miracle turnaround in my own health. I'm not saying I could cure myself of hepatitis C. I don't really believe people can, but I certainly was able to roll back all these terrible symptoms I'd been experiencing just by improving my diet and lifestyle and getting some other factors, more physical conditioning and things woven into my daily life. And these terrible, debilitating symptoms I'd been experiencing for the previous 3 years that had basically run my career into the ground, they disappeared very quickly. And so then I was just in a holding pattern, waiting for years, for two decades. Will we ever have a cure for this? And I came to the conclusion that we wouldn't. My initial strategy was, okay, I'm just going to stay as healthy as I can for as long as I can until a real cure that's non-toxic comes along. That was my thinking for years. And then so many years elapsed that I just decided there's never going to be a cure for this in my lifetime. There's no progress being made. We only had interferon and ribavirin as a combo, an injectable combo with interferon injections, highly toxic, brutally toxic, very prolonged treatment, often lasting for a year or more, destroying people's health and lives in the process, offering a very low likelihood of cure. So I never did that. And then, boom, all of a sudden, the cure is discovered. And, you know, it's a mad rush to see who can get it, because it was priced so at and is still priced so astronomically high that even though everybody on the planet who has hepatitis C, and it's estimated that 180 million people at least worldwide have hepatitis C, every one of those cases could be cured before the end of this year if we could put the drugs that now exist into every one of those people's bodies. But that isn't happening. It will probably have hepatitis C with us for many years, for decades more. We could see the end of it. It's like possible with the cure that now exists to see the end of this by the end of this year, if only it didn't cost so much, if only everybody who had it actually were tested and knew they had it. There's just a lot of barriers, economic and logistical, to seeing this eradicated by year's end, but it is in theory possible because the cure is now here.
You talked about the price of one pill, that and that the 12-week course would cost somebody $95,000. So there might be a cure, but how many people can afford that,
well,
short of the fact of being in a clinical trial?
You're right. Now we're really getting down to the nitty-gritty, aren't we, of the political economy in which this cure has been brought forth and is currently being disseminated. That is really the nub of the problem. You wouldn't believe the battles that are going on many different fronts to address this problem of exorbitant drug pricing. There are all sorts of legal challenges in play right now, some at the national level in the U.S., some at the international and global level. There are private lawsuits, there are collective class action suits going on to challenge the exorbitant drug prices, and mainly this is aimed at Gilead Sciences, which is the pharmaceutical company that has developed, not discovered, but developed the backbone of the cure, which is a drug called sofosbuvir that they went on to brand name Sovaldi. They branded it with the name Sovaldi, so people may have heard of Sovaldi. And then Sovaldi is the underlying drug in Harvoni, the one that cured me. So, yes, the wholesale price that Gilead has placed on Sovaldi, it is $1,000 per pill. The wholesale price it placed on Harvoni is $1,125 a pill. So yes, you need 84 of these pills. Say you need the normal 12 weeks. The wholesale acquisition cost for Sovaldi would be $84,000 US, and for Harvoni would be $94,500. So you're right. Not only does this make it out of reach to individuals, it actually makes it out of reach for insurance companies to at least treat everybody right now today. So consequently, we have this huge filtering mechanism going on where only the sickest are treated, only the most urgent, and everybody else, including people like me, someone who had it for 45 years, I wasn't sick enough yet. My liver wasn't damaged enough yet. I hadn't tried the toxic drug that is brutal and prolonged and doesn't work yet. And so I didn't qualify. There's no way I would have gotten the drugs. And this is the story if I hadn't managed to get into this clinical trial. So you're right. People are using clinical trials, or they're in the U.S., there's kind of quite a pattern now of people appealing. You appeal the initial insurance company denial, and they deny again, and then you appeal their second denial, and they deny that, and then you go to an independent review board. And in virtually all of those cases, the insurance company denials are overturned. But this can take a year, and people are often very sick with hepatitis C and are just stressed and emotionally falling apart. It's extremely taxing and damaging to their health to have to wage a big battle like this that can last a year. But that is one thing that's happening in the U.S. that shows a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. But the very interesting thing that's happening is this increasing trade in drug tourism and people buying generic versions of these drugs from overseas, from India, from China, India and China in particular. I mean, we're talking, they're a fraction of the cost there. Or there's now a really good, solid channel for doing this through a global clinical trial called the Redemption Trials being run out of Australia by what started as the Australia Buyers Club, modeled after the Dallas Buyers Club, which was had figured out a way to provide cheap generic versions of the hepatitis C cure to anybody who was either in Australia or could get themselves to Australia. But then the Harvoni, that would cost wholesale price $94,500, they could, through the redemption trial, buy it for $1,600, buy their whole 12-week course and be cured. I mean, this is what happens if you release the cure, make it inaccessible to the vast majority of people who need it. People are going to find a way, and that's happened now in a very organized way.
Well, Kim, take us on a little journey here about your book. It's written in such an interesting format, so I'll let you explain that to us, and maybe why did you choose to go that route?
Well, yeah, I have to say it wasn't a conscious choice. It's just the way the mind of a poet works and the way creative process works. But the form I used for this book, I'm both basically, well, I write a lot of different things, but my primary writing in the 40 years that I've supported myself as a writer has been as a journalist and as a poet. And so there happens to be a literary form that in a way combines, if you believe it or not, combines those two. And it's hundreds of years old, and it's called haibun. It was really first launched or popularized. It's a Japanese literary form. It was first launched essentially by Matsuo Basho, who is probably Japan's most famous and revered poet. And in the 17th century, he took a very long and arduous foot journey through the northern interior of Japan, and that's been translated into English many times, many versions, as Narrow Road to the Interior. It is a book of haibun, and what haibun is, it's often, and by Basho was used as a travel diary, and usually in its more contemporary incarnations is also often used as a travel diary format. So you have like a paragraph of usually somewhat lyrical descriptive prose, and then it's punctuated with a haiku poem at the end of that. And haiku, of course, is a very short, three-line form of poetry. So I started this clinical trial. I happened to be reading Basho's classic Narrow Road to the Interior. You know, at the time I was reading it, I was sitting on the fence about, oh, should I do this clinical trial? You would think anybody would want to get cured of hepatitis C, but no, you know, most of us, we've lived in such a protective state of our bodies for so long in keeping ourselves healthy while living with hepatitis C that we don't want to take any pills. We don't want to take any drugs. So it's like, oh, my God, what's going to happen to me if I go forward with this trial? And then I was reading this book, and I decided I'm going to document my own journey in exactly this form. I'm going to be taking my own narrow road to the interior and write a book, a sort of a modern parallel contemporary version of what Basho did four centuries ago. And then I got very excited about going into the trial, not to cure myself. You'd think a normal person would want to enter a clinical trial to cure themselves, but no, with a poet, poets are nuts, and so a poet wants to enter it because she's going to get a book out of it. So,
would you read us just a short example of that?
Yes. Let's see what I have here. Well, I'll read, this part is actually about Basho and my reflection on him. This is day 13. Every day I feel the pull of the forest. I crave the soft embrace of its mossy limbs. A northern flicker drops from an alder to the river's edge to poke among the stones. I stand with my palms against the deeply furrowed bark of a Douglas fir tree, more than 300 years old. In five element theory, the underpinning for Chinese medicine, the liver's element is wood. Its color green. So the forest is the planet's liver, the purifier, the bearer of each assault, absorbing all until the end. This colossus was just a seedling when Basho trod his narrow road. I let the giant talk to the fir tree inside me, and I begin to understand. On the concrete base of a bridge long gone, I sit and let my mind cross.
Beautiful. Well, in wrapping up, Kim, let's tell our listeners where they can get a copy of your book and learn more about what you are doing.
The books are available directly from me. They can go onto my website, which is pigsquashpress.com, and that will get them pretty quickly. They'll see some link there for ordering books. So the books are $19 and are available directly from me one way or another. People can use PayPal to get them, or they can send me a check. And, yep, free shipping in North America.
All right. Pig Squash Press.
Yeah, pigsquashpress.com. And I would just, you know, encourage listeners that everybody really needs to be tested for hepatitis C, and nobody needs to fear the outcome of the test because the cure is actually available. A few weeks' worth of pills and you'll be cured. Yes, it's hard right now to get access to the new drugs because of the high cost, but there are other channels, perfectly legitimate, and so everybody will find a way to get the cure, and they will be cured in a basically easy, painless manner.
Thank you for sharing this, and congratulations on your health and your new book, and it's just an exciting time for you.
It's like a whole new life. I really literally don't know who I'll be without hepatitis. I'm as eager as anybody to find out who I'm going to be without it.
Be new and improved.
Yes, definitely. Thank you very much, Pat, for having me on your show again.
After the show, be sure to visit the website speakupandstayalive.com for more life-saving information. Plus, that's where you can purchase the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, The Patient Advocate, Hospital Survival Guide. Bring the book to the hospital with you. It's the best way to stand out and in a positive way. And remember, we donate 2 handmade pillowcases to a local veteran's shelter for every book sold with your name on it as the donor. So for a mere $20, you benefit, and so does some well-deserving warrior. Give a meaningful and useful gift that really says, I care. Give the gift of healthcare safety. Purchase the book, the patient safety logs, and throw in some of those icebreaker cards. It's a one-size-fits-all present that everybody needs. You can order online at speakupandstayalive.com, or you can request by email at speak@speakupandstayalive.com, or call me 440-725-5462.
Don't stop.
Second opinions. Yes, when it comes to your health, I say, don't stop. Don't stop asking. Don't stop researching. Don't stop thinking. Don't stop believing. Let's talk about the word opinion. You know me, I'm a Latin fan. No, not talking about J-Lo or Ricky Martin. Latin, the language. The word opinion, from Latin opinion, means conjecture, fancy, belief, what one thinks. And from the stem of opinari, the Latin stem, think, judge, suppose. Notice, nowhere does it indicate the word fact. An opinion is not a hard fact. It is a view or judgment formed about something, not necessarily based on fact or knowledge. Or the beliefs or views of a large number or majority of people about a particular thing. Many people, when told that they have cancer or another life-threatening illness, feel that they must make a decision right then and begin treatment that very same day. And while this may be true in some cases, taking the time to learn about your disease, getting a second opinion, or perhaps even a third opinion, and weighing your options is a very reasonable approach. And you as the patient have every right to make informed decisions that, heck, ultimately affect your life. But many people fear their doctors, and they worry that the doctor might become upset if, when the question comes up about seeking a second opinion. I would think that most doctors would welcome another physician's input. Many people suggest that you ask your doctor to recommend someone to give you a second opinion. Personally, I wouldn't do that. I'd go completely outside of the practice, outside of the hospital system, and to go into this realizing that doctors' opinions may differ. According to the Patient Advocate Foundation, they say, a different doctor may come up with a different diagnosis, or at least offer a different opinion as to treatment choices, and not every doctor will have the same opinion with regard to diseases and possible treatments. Factors which may have an effect on a doctor's opinion are the technology available to that doctor, school of thought, where they were trained, individual methods of treatment and experience in dealing with that particular diagnosis. So it's clear that treatment methods may differ. Some doctors prefer to monitor the situation and use less aggressive procedures before moving to surgical interventions. Some doctors like to use more aggressive treatments from the beginning. But by getting a second opinion, you can expand your options about different treatment methods which may be most suitable for you and your situation. I say being informed is always your best option. Plus, if you hear the same diagnosis or treatment option from two or more doctors, you'll feel a bit more confident with your decision. And here's another not-so-nice idea. Because doctors are human, their decisions may be influenced by business, not just medicine. Now, I'm certainly not saying that a doctor would recommend something to harm you, but it's the law of the instrument, the law of the hammer, that says give a boy a hammer and everything looks like a nail. In other words, a surgeon might be more inclined to suggest surgery versus let's wait and see. Or perhaps when more than one treatment option has a similar rate of success, the doctor may make a recommendation that is better for his or her business and not necessarily better for you. I know about this. This happened to me a few years ago. Do you remember when I told you how I went kayaking a while back and how the stairs on the dock totally sheared off as I was climbing down, causing me to fall and have the stairs land on my foot? Well, I went to the urgent care. They x-rayed and wrapped the foot. A few weeks later, I went to a sports medicine doctor who helped somewhat. And then months later, as it was still hurting when I walked, I went to a foot specialist. This guy walked in, didn't wash his hands, took a look at my foot, mumbled some words I did not understand, I think they were in another language, and announced immediate surgery. He then walked out, no goodbyes, and sent his assistant in to make the arrangements. Oh, I myself said goodbye and never went back. And today, I'm walking just fine, no pains, no problems. As I look back, this doctor was all about surgery. He was a surgeon. That was his instrument, and my freshly painted pink toenails were just calling for a nice fine slice. Statistics show that over 1/3 of adults in the United States will never seek a second opinion, and almost 1/10 of newly diagnosed patients rarely or never understand their diagnoses. I'm going to guess it's a bigger number than that. Studies have shown that 30% of patients who sought second opinions for elective surgery found that the two opinions were not in agreement. These studies are one more reason why you need to make sure you are educated properly to make the best decision for your health. So when seeking a second opinion, what should you do? First, check with your insurance provider to determine coverage, especially if the visit is out of your network. Assuming it is medically necessary, most insurance plans will pay for at least part of the cost, while Medicare will pay 80% of the cost. And if the second opinion doesn't agree with the first, Medicare will pay 80% of the cost of a third opinion. Patients that belong to a Medicare HMO are entitled to a second opinion, but some plans require a referral from your primary care physician. And like most HMO treatments, you must seek an in-network physician. So there's a lot to know. To learn about second opinions, you can go to Medicare.gov. They also have an 800 number, which is 800-MEDICARE. Also, be sure to check to see that the new specialist accepts your insurance type. Diagnostic tests can be very expensive, not to mention invasive. And if you're talking about x-rays and CAT scans, those subject you to high doses of radiation. And many insurance providers will not pay for them if they were completed for the initial diagnosis. So again, lots of reasons to have copies of the tests that you've already had done so you don't repeat them, both for financial purposes and for health-related purposes. Bring your medical records, including copies of all scans, exams, previous treatments, blood tests, and pathology slides with you to the appointment. Be clear what you're looking for from the second opinion. Do you need confirmation that your current treatment recommendation is correct for you? Or are you looking for other options? Are you interested in clinical trials? Alternative modalities? You know, sometimes there may not be time to get a second opinion. Getting a second opinion may delay treatment that you might need. So if you have a serious medical condition, you should take this into account when deciding to ask for a second opinion. Bottom line, remember, the root of the word, Latin, opinare, which means think, judge, suppose. And notice nowhere does it indicate the word fact. And given that a set of symptoms does not take into account you as a unique individual, an opinion simply cannot be a hard fact. It is a view or a judgment, not necessarily based on the knowledge of you, your mindset, your genetics, your will. As I said at the beginning, when it comes to your health, I say, don't stop. Don't stop asking. Don't stop researching. Don't stop thinking. And certainly, don't stop believing. Do you or a loved one need to rehabilitate after a hospital stay and don't know where to go? With so many choices, how do you safely choose? Well, I have the answer. The Welsh Home, located in Rocky River, Ohio. Let's spend the next 2 minutes with Lauren Teschner to get some advice. Welcome, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Lauren, how does the Welsh Home help patients transition back home?
We establish goals on day one of them admitting to the Welsh Home and make sure that they can reach those goals before they go home. And we do that through physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, nursing needs, and also the social work piece of it. We have a social worker on staff who's going to make sure that the patient is safe to go home, make sure that they have all the equipment in their home that they're going to need once they return home, and make sure that it's going to be a successful transition. We would never want to transition someone back to their home that we knew was not going to succeed. So we want to make sure that we do our best to accomplish their goals for a safe return home.
Thank you so much, Lauren.
You're welcome.
The Welsh Home offers state-of-the-art skilled rehabilitation therapy on site to meet the individual needs of each and every resident. Whether you are looking for short-term or long-term care, the Welsh Home can help. And you don't have to be Welsh to call the Welsh Home your home. Call them to arrange for a tour. 440-331-0420. That's 440-331-0420. Or visit welshhome.com.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety. As usual, we've covered and uncovered a lot today, and that's good. You know, we talked about medical malpractice today, and I very specifically stay away from that most of the time because it truly is not a place or a space I want to be or want you to be. And that is why I also brought up second opinions, because the more active of a role you play in your own healthcare, the safer you'll be. Just recently, a friend of ours was diagnosed with cancer, and when I asked her a few basic questions about her diagnosis, just conversation, she had no idea. She didn't know exactly what she had, didn't know what the surgery or treatment entailed, didn't know how long she'd be in the hospital. All she knew was that she was going in for surgery next Tuesday. Well, now that sounds like a recipe for disaster. In what other life situation would a reasonably intelligent person simply take the word of someone else without asking questions? Would a person go to a car dealer and say, I need to buy a new car, and drive out with the car the salesman said to buy? Do people go to restaurants and allow the waitress to order for them? Do we allow the grocery store cashier to fill our buggies with their choice of food? Nowhere. Nowhere would we allow this type of decision-making, yet go to your doctor and all bets are off. No questions, no input, no conversations, like tiny little lambs to slaughter. Tell me what to do and I will do it. So I say, avoid the potential for errors and become part of the team, whether your doctor likes it or not. They wouldn't be in business if it were not for you. You are the customer, the consumer, the guy or gal waving the cash. So let's all of us start acting like we have control, because we do. No one wants to be involved in a medical lawsuit. Not only is it a difficult process, it also means that you have been harmed. And I know we all want to avoid that. Now, this is not to say that sometimes things way beyond our control go terribly wrong, but being informed, connected to the dialogue, an active participant just may thwart potential harm. And this takes me to next week's guest, who has a company that does healthcare mystery shopping, employing secret agents of sorts to observe patient-doctor encounters in hospitals as a way for the hospital to improve patient safety and the patient experience. Oh, I'd love to be one of those shoppers, wouldn't you? Well, we will learn more about this next week, so be sure to come back. But until then, visit the website, speakupandstayalive.com, to order your very own copy of the book, Speak Up and Stay Alive, the book that started it all. The best way to avoid medical harm is to become informed ahead of time, and this book will do that for you. It's only $19.95 plus a few dollars for shipping, but certainly worth its weight in gold and worth your life. And while you're at the website, visit the link that says Book Pat to Speak, and you'll find some of the places where I've spoken about healthcare and hospital safety. And if you belong to a group, a club, business, church, or a hospital, send the program person to that page and ask them to book me to speak to your group. I'd love to meet you and share all I know as fast as I can in an hour or less. I can guarantee that your crowd will love it. That's speakupandstayalive.com or call me 440-725-5462. 440-725-5462. Okay, we are really out of time. So I'm going to see you next week. Same time, same place, but never the same information. Until then, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week. I am Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.